been a laborious introduction to what Martin Luther calls the five verses, I think six, the five verses that are the most important in the Bible. Understand these five verses, you understand the message of the whole Bible. Understand these verses, you understand the message of the whole book of Romans. The text in the King James, 3rd chapter, 21st verse, "But now, every great preacher that's preached on Romans, Barnhouse, James Boyce, almost without exception, have a message entitled, But Now. Meaning, obviously, there was something before, but now we're moving into something different. And that now, I scratched it out because it's not there in the original, but leave it in so we're quoting the King James right. But now the righteousness of God without, again, they've added, for a reason, the law is manifested. The reason they added this is because the Greek that's being translated and the English likewise have an ambiguous word for law, which makes room for interpretation and causes a host of modern scholars to say Paul was confused in his use of the word law. No, he was extremely sophisticated in the history of the word in the Greek language, which he was using to communicate this magnus opus of his faith, the book of Romans. And he uses it with a versatility, and you can never understand what his particularity of use is without cross-referencing other translations and without knowing the multiple uses of the word, and the context tells you which among many uses he means. The Greek, noonday, their form of syntax, the dare but, can't start the sentence. This is the key word now. So if you're reading an interlinear, they'll have a little one under this word and a two under that one. This is review, and I know it. I'm getting to the Syriac and the Coptic today. But the point is, the two original languages for most of the Bible, the Hebrew and the Greek. But history sort of channeled itself from the 4th century onward. The oldest complete Bibles we have copies of them. 4th century, written about 340 A.D., the Vaticanus and the Sinaiticus. The Alexandrinus, the 5th century, had more influence, even though it wasn't available when they translated the King James. Other manuscripts, including a portion of the Gospels and Acts, the Bezae manuscript, 6th century, and 10th and 11th century manuscripts, which mostly rely upon the 5th century Alexandrinus, so they didn't have access. The Council of Nicaea entrenched the church. The vote was enforced by the Emperor Constantine, and all voted because they were told if they didn't vote yes, they'd be excommunicated, banished to the mines, and only two did not vote in the great Arian controversy. And the Western Church, of which we're a part, has been almost kept in the dark about the historic Middle Eastern spread of Christianity. For the first 3 centuries, most of Rome was populated by, they were the true barbarians. I'm talking about most of the Roman Empire in Europe, not Rome itself. Mostly Gauls and Celts that had no real sophisticated culture, built no libraries. I'm not talking about the city of Rome. But the Middle East for the first 3 centuries, Arabia, Syria, the language of the Middle East from 700 B.C. to 700 A.D. was Aramaic. When the Jews came back from Babylon, in Nehemiah 8:8, as I've referenced about 10 times in this particular series, it says they read from the scrolls, and then the priests or rabbis who understood Hebrew and read it explained the meaning to the people, who in the 70 years in Babylon had adopted the language of the Western Persian Empire, Aramaic. That began the Targums, which means translation. First it was oral, and then they reduced it to writing. An Aramaic translation of the Old Testament. And as I said, a small portion of Daniel and 2 other books is written in Aramaic. The Aramaic ruled. A dialect of the Aramaic, Syriac. And when in Acts 2 they say, how hear we these in all these different languages? All these be Galileans. Galilee, Palestine spoke Aramaic. The men on the street didn't speak Hebrew, they spoke Aramaic. And those that were educated enough, because of Alexander the Great conquering the area and had been there for 3 centuries before Christ, the educated spoke a second language, Greek. So when we have Jesus talking, he's going to be speaking either ordinary Aramaic most of the time, or he's going to be speaking Syriac, since he's a Galilean, which is a dialect of the Aramaic. In Egypt, their language goes back to the hieroglyphics. It was thought to be picture writing until Napoleon's soldier uncovered the Rosetta Stone, and then it took a long time before Champollion broke the code, because it was 3 different languages on the Rosetta Stone, and they discovered hieroglyphics is an alphabet. And that alphabet proceeded from the drawings to the Demotic script. But when you look at the hieroglyphic letters alongside the Demotic script, you can see they're adapted from, for example, the A, which is not Demotic, is adapted from the falcon that sits there and looks with his profile like an A, and that's gone into many languages. The Egyptian culture predated Christianity and predated the Aramaic, but Alexander the Great, after building Alexandria, Greek became the language of the cultured people. It was in Alexandria that the Old Testament was translated into Greek, which became the Bible of the New Testament, the Septuagint. And Mark, companion of Paul, eventually, told to bring him, because Paul needs him, and bring the scrolls. Mark, every record in Egypt, indeed Arius, who was cast out in the Nicene Council over the controversy between the Arius view and that of primarily Cyrus of Alexandria, or Cyril, rather, of Alexandria. Arius pastored the church in a suburb of the city where Mark was buried. His martyrdom was to be dragged to death in the streets of Alexandria, and he was the first bishop in the line, clear today, of the bishops of the church who now have adapted to the ritual language of the Bohairic Coptic. He is the first, as Linus, the son of the British king is the first of the popes out of that household of Claudius and the household of that hero that was never defeated, Caractacus, as they call him in Latin. And as you know, in the story of Tacitus is mentioned as so moving the Senate as he was marched before the Caesar and the Senate that they gave him house arrest and a stipend from Siluria, his kingdom in Britain. And it's out of that stream that Constantine comes, and Helen, who restored the artifacts first in the Middle Ages. All eyes in those early years pointed to the birthbed of the Christian faith. Paul's, how many know Paul had three missionary journeys? How many know that? He set out in each of those three missionary journeys at Antioch. At Antioch, Christians were first called Christians. At Antioch, the issue came up that caused the first church council. And they had to then meet at Jerusalem to see whether or not Gentiles could be allowed in without having to keep the Jewish law in all of its respects. In other words, to become a Christian, you believed in Jesus as Messiah, but you still went through the process of a proselyte, circumcision, rituals, law, both the ritual and liturgical laws and the behavioral laws. You became a Jew. Antioch caused that fight. Antioch is Syriac. They spoke Syriac and the mother tongue Aramaic. From Antioch, he took his missionary journeys, and as I said last Sunday, or the one before, people just read right past. Just go right past. Paul, after his conversion on the Damascus Road, Damascus is in Syria. They spoke Syriac, or the mother tongue Aramaic, or if they're educated, Greek. And there was a little Jewish conclave, there might be one that could speak Jewish. After the house of the man that never saw Paul before, but told him his history and by God's command prayed over him and his blindness was healed, after the blinding of the Damascus Road experience, Scripture says he went to Arabia. 3.5 years in Arabia. You think he's not going to preach his message? You think he's not going to preach his message at Antioch? Obviously, it's where the first Christians, he wasn't the one, Barnabas was, but he spread his message. He was constantly stirring up the synagogues to preach the message. It's obvious that there was a boiling pot, and these letters, in fact, the letter that Paul wrote to Ephesians, to the scholars listening, they know. But it may be a surprise to you, since I preached verse by verse through Ephesians, that the earliest manuscripts of Ephesians do not say to the Ephesians. In essence, it was a circular letter to be circulated among all the churches with the particular church tagged on later if a copy were made, because it was to all the churches to be circulated. It's in this New Testament world that you find manuscripts still that obviously had access to manuscripts we don't have. And as I pull all of the blinds sideways and look at these translations, in languages of that area who first received the gospel, and obviously they're going to get their first manuscripts in Greek. But converted scholars were very quick to translate into the language of the people, and they were translating manuscripts that carried the Greek that we don't have. It's ironic that the oldest manuscripts we have, the Chester Beatty papyri in the room of the book, taking us back to the early 2nd century, the oldest piece of papyri, I held up the cover of it because it's on loan to me, seeking permission to put a copy on display. This is a section of John's Gospel, about 120 to 150, that old. That means that in Egypt, where Coptic is spoken, both the Sahidic and the Boharic mainly, but two others as well, but the Boharic has become the language of the church. Sahidic, the Upper Nile, they had Greek manuscripts that graced the museums of the world as 2 centuries earlier than the oldest complete Bible. And the oldest complete Bible, the Sinaitic, was found at the proverbial location of Mount Sinai at St. Catherine's Monastery. In other words, I'm assembling the manuscripts and digging with you to compare our ambiguous English translation, which talks about the law and righteousness, and a simple little innocuous word, without. You can be without for a time and get it back. You can be without in that you are not full, incomplete. Without has an ambiguity that can't be pinned down. So what I have done is dig into all these different manuscripts of the church world prior to the 4th century, those that had manuscripts dating clear back to the 2nd century, and try to see, as we assemble all of them, we can't find the Vorlage. Where is a copy of Paul's own written letter through a secretary or himself? We'll never find it. The papyri or the tablets or the scrolls deteriorate, but we can get the closest copyists that had access to an earlier manuscript, not yet subject to as many human flaws. And the miracle to me is that in the 5,000 manuscripts found since the King James was translated, the variations are very small, but where it's critical is the variations, particularly in the last 3 centuries, are variations many times deliberate to twist to a previously held doctrinal position. That's why we camped out on the faith of Jesus, or simple belief in Jesus. Likewise, what law is Paul talking about? You will never know with just the Greek. But the Greek that these other people had earlier, I remember when I first started this Roman series, on festival, before I started the messages, I handed out, as a dot note, copies of the 1st chapter of Romans in the Sinaitic, oldest Bible in the world. Any of you remember getting those? Capital letters, no punctuation, no spacing. That's 4th century. Paul wrote this in 58 A.D. from Corinth. But it circulated. Wherever he went, they were making copies. And those copies that circulated between 58 A.D. and the oldest that we have, now I do have When I get to the fifth chapter of Romans, the Chester Beatty manuscripts, the papyri, picks up at the fifth chapter and essentially finishes the book. So in those passages, I'm back to second century. But up until the fifth chapter, and these critical verses, whomever translated it first from the Greek to the Hebrew, right after the day of Pentecost, we find in Acts many Pharisees were converted. And they're going to want to talk and communicate to other Pharisees. And about the time a copy of Romans in Greek arrives in Jerusalem to the mother church, and you think that Paul isn't going to, when he's delivering, each time when he comes back from his three missionary trips, he's delivering money to the church at Jerusalem. After the Roman letter sent from Corinth by Phyllis to Rome, the minute they would get their hands on it, they would translate this into the Hebrew. Ironically, because they would have an earlier Greek manuscript, they're going to choose a word that has no ambiguity. Here's the starting point and the conjunction wa, wata, negalota. This tells you it's in the passive sense, and the grammar you don't have to memorize. I'm not stupid. I want the insight to come to you. And as I pull it apart, your own common sense will tell you, I understand what he's saying. I don't have to remember it, but I can get the point, which is, this is a passive happening. We know what passive is, and when this sign of the nipple, negalota, has that in front of it, we know it's passive. So whatever it is, and now, wata, and now, something is happening that I have no part in. I don't participate. I don't work to get it. I don't struggle to have it. It lands on me. That's the passive tense. You're not doing anything. Passive means it's raining on me. I'm not grabbing clouds and squeezing water out. It's just raining on me. Whatever is happening, and the importance of the but now, is that up until this point, from the 18th verse of the first chapter, Paul has done a landslide destruction of all the ways of works, whether you are acting on a conscience that produces an ethical performance better than the Jews that had a special revelation, or whether you're a Jew with the Word of God given on Mount Sinai, you fall short. Duty, performance, works, which Paul later will in Colossians call will worship, do this and don't do that. It qualifies as righteousness in the Old Testament because God made a covenant. And tzedekah, which is the word for righteousness, requires persons who commit contract, covenant. God covenanted with these people. And he covenanted a law of works, a law of deeds. Do this, and it has no tolerance or mercy for anything short of perpetual perfection. You have to do it from the moment you come out of the womb till you die, and one mistake, perfection's gone. And this covenant said, do it, and you'll live. God gave that covenant. Don't do it, and you die. And by the way, Jesus did it and lived. But he did that as incidental to qualifying for his real work, which was to remove that covenant. God's going to keep his word. So Jesus fulfilled it, and it was nailed to the tree. That Torah, Paul wants it understood, that Torah died. And now, since righteousness produces only frustration and failure under the do-do-this formula, but that's not the exhaustion of God's options. But now, the righteousness of God without the law, they added, the translators, the personal, or the determiner, the definite article, because they recognize just saying law doesn't do it. Nomos, broad in its meaning, one of the few areas where the Greek is ambiguous. Even the King James recognized you need to separate law from general law and give it a title, the law, which in the context of what he's been talking about up to that point of the chapter, they knew he was talking about the Torah. But when they translate back to the Hebrew, but now, or and now, there is uncovered negelota. You encountered that word in Isaiah 53 in the miracle services. Who he amends the hearing of us, and to whom is the arm of the Lord passive. You don't grab it. Negelota. Revealed. This is an uncovering of something that enables us to see without having done anything to encounter it or have it displayed. And what is it that's uncovered? Tzedekut. T.S. Dek. Tzedekut is the word. There's your Q, your D, the T.S., or Z, and that just adds something irrelevant to the present time. It's the Tzedekut Elohim of God. All of a sudden, the Greek now says, what is being uncovered, the righteousness, is a contract kind of relationship, which is the word Tzedekut. God's uncovering a new basis for relationship, a new contract, which obviously presupposes we have the option to take the covenant, but we didn't provide it. It isn't by our works. We didn't earn it. It's a Tzedekut, a contract, covenant, righteousness of God. Bibli, without, is kind of ambiguous. Bibli is not. Bibli says, what one brings with one. I'm bringing this writer for the board. When I come on the platform, it's already here, but I brought my books with me. That's what Bibli with the negative added means. It's what you bring with you when you come metaphorically into a subject or into an occasion or into a position or into a state. What Bibli says, bringing nothing. But bringing nothing is specific because it's tied, as the Arabic is on Adlaw, bringing nothing with you into this righteousness of Torah. That's your word. Torah. Bringing nothing of Torah. Well, now we know we're talking about the law of the Old Testament and all of it that demands performance of deeds and avoidance of other deeds and a measurement of perfection as the way to be righteous. The Arabic, falana, Fa here means just like but now. A stark contrast is going to occur. I can't say this word because you've got to gargle with the second one like the French R. It's barriere. You can say it, barriere. You got to gargle when you say it. Say it for me. See, I can't say that. But I know what it means. I know exactly what it means, and it's like I never could trill my R's. School, as a kid, I got in fights because people thought they were superior to me because they could trill their R's. And I couldn't trill mine, but I could knock the trill out of there. I can't say barriere. I can't. Barriere. Barriere. I can't do it. But I know what it means. Having no connection to Sharia, which is God-given laws of behavior. Maximized in the use of that word for the Quran and the theology of the Quran that God rules through the state and the only law you need is the Sharia, the God-given rules of behavior. These are work-oriented, do this, don't do that, laws of behavior designed, if you keep it, to make you righteous. Willpower, stubborn, dedicated, disciplined performance of the rules. So the ambiguity of nomos is taken out with Sharia, is taken out with Torah, and we know that we're not just talking about any other law. We know why the definite article is put here. It's that, come on now, get on my page. All the Sister Sals, all the so-called clothesline preachers, all the hide-splitting preachers have just rediscovered some Old Testament law. Now, am I saying it's okay to murder? No. I'm saying that you are not righteous because fear of getting caught keeps you from murdering when in your heart you want to. I mean, there's a lot of people I want to kill. You can't drive the freeways without wanting that. But I don't do it. That doesn't make me righteous. Just makes me scared of consequences. But when God's Spirit is generated in you, your wanter changes. You don't want to kill. I don't want to do things for my wife because I want to be a good husband. I mean, I've seen them. In fact, some of the worst situations are those where they, to their wife, overdo their sweetness. Oh, my honey baby. And they're putting on that show because they've just been catting around. Now you know so much. I live 74 years now. Most of Christianity is wearing that blanket of willpower, and most of Christianity is coerced activity, and most of Christianity is done to please or appease the wrath of fellow Christians. When you have the born-again experience genuine, which is a gift from God, your wonder changes. You're a new creature. But I'm not to that part of Romans yet. The point is, the law, Torah, Sharia. Now, the Syriac, Hasa, Dayin, but Now, Dala. Da is of or with, and La is not or nothing. Of nothing, no Musa. Well, you know where they got that, don't you? Now, come on, get on the page with me. This is not as complicated as it looks. It just looks that way. Where do you think they got the word nomos? The Greek nuni dei kolis, nomu. So they're not going to help us too much. And they confirm the manuscripts we have on nomu because they obviously, whatever manuscript they had earlier, was using the word, which is what is causing me to go to the other languages, because of the ambiguity of nomu and nomus. So it didn't seem to bother the Coptic translator, or rather the Syriac translator. They just went straight from the Greek to nomusa. But righteousness suddenly changes. Kanuto, or kanuta. Kanuta, de, or da, Allaha, God, of God. So we know it's the righteousness of God. But this is an interesting word. It, I've hinted at it before. It goes clear back in their days when the king or the Khan was worshipped as God, and anything he said was righteousness. It goes back to the possible roots in the Greek. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
The Greek. There's a marvelous little book for somebody that wants to really dig. Scribes and Schools by Philip R. Davies, Library of Ancient Israel. Scribes and Schools, the Canonization of Hebrew Scriptures. Got a nice discussion of a possible connection. The historical definition of canon is a good way to begin a history of canonization. Literally, the Greek word kanon, we're not talking about nomu here, we're talking about canon. Signifies a straight rod. It was perhaps the implicit quality of straightness that led to its connoting not just a physical ruler, such as a carpenter would use, but an abstract standard like we use in colloquial, what's the yardstick of your behavior? Thus, canon was accordingly used by Greeks to refer to the rules by which poetry or music could be composed or geometric shapes measured. Thus, for example, in the middle of the 5th century B.C., the title canon was given to two textbooks dealing with sculpture. The apparent curious connection thus established between artistic creation and canon remained in Greek culture into the Hellenistic period. And the notion of a perfect work of art as representing the ideal to be studied and copied is fundamental to the Greek concept of canon. For the perfect work is itself a canon because it both enshrines and demonstrates the rules or the art in question, the eternal as against the ephemeral. And since for Socrates and his circle, goodness was the supreme art and knowledge the way to it, the good man can, as Aristotle says, be a canon of human nobility. Then they go on to the notion of determining a set of books as a canon, which is now pretty generally when you go to dictionaries, the word canon will first reference the Bible. But I dug a little deeper into this Syriac, learned some interesting things. The canon, am I boring you? It comes from con, which means existed or to begin to be. Or it means did to be corrected, did correct. Or it also includes did bend down to do that correcting. That's the root of the word. So, in essence, what we're talking about is a standard, a pattern, which ties it to the Greek word Canaan, or Canaan, or Canon. We're talking about something similar to nomos, which could be everything from a god named Nomos, personalized to the state as a polis, being deified, because somebody has to tell you what straight is. Somebody has to decide what it is that is being canonized and made the pattern. And the word in the Syriac includes all of that. It implies a bending down to create, to become or be existing, and it implies with canon the pattern idea. So here we have not a Slavish translation of a cognate word just carrying nomos over. We have a word in the Syriac that embraces that full plethora that something new is happening. Something new that I did nothing about, something new passively, which I'll come to, is being displayed, and someone with the ability and right authority to do this, a canonizer, one who can say, this is the pattern. This is Canuta. And remember again and again, when I go to the next verse, this concept of pattern. What was Jesus the pattern of? Charles Sheldon, be like Jesus and imitate his acts on earth. He didn't just come. He wouldn't have saved anybody if his prayer in the garden had been answered instantly when he says, restore me to the glory that I had. He had to go to the cross for this new righteousness to be available. He had to be raised for this new righteousness to have the pattern. Remember pattern, but in the Syriac, we have all this wrapped up in Canuta. A bending down by the canonizer. A creation and bringing into being of something new. With, to go back to the Hebrew, with nothing. To go back to the Arabic, with no connection to something new is becoming the pattern called righteousness. And where do we go from there? It is a righteousness or a pattern of God. Of God. Something out of himself is carried in this word. And then we come to at Goliath. But I normally don't put the vowel signs up. This, in the grammar of the Syriac, is your symbol, just like the N is the symbol of the niphil, passive in the Hebrew. The prefix at, A-T, in the Syriac tells you this is passive, simple passive. But to make it intensely passive, going beyond, instead of a rain, floodgates open. You add these little markers. And now you have what in the grammar, for the grammarians that know the Syriac, you have FPL, which is analogous to the stem system of the Hebrews, but it tells you that this is intensely, intensely passive. Passive because of the prefix, intensely passive because of the vowel signs. Now, what is intensely passive? Gliat, revealed, shining forth as a light, shining forth, bursting forth to be seen with intensity, and I do nothing. It's there to be received and seen, and a new understanding, but now a new understanding of righteousness is going to light up the house, because He of God bends down and creates something new. The Coptic Boharic, like the Greek, a borrowed word, the tenu. But now, Akshni, a demotic letter out of the ancient Egyptian script. Their grammar, now watch this, their grammar, this puts it in the past, was the A. And, but now, connected to the next A down here, this which is happening is without. This is the simple word just connected with the link up of the A. Because that which comes from above never was connected. And this new thing is, but now without, here's your definite article, the nomos. So again, the Coptic and the Syriac simply borrow a cognate word with the definite article in front of it, seeing the same problem that the English translators had, that is not just any law, so we have to add a law that distinguishes it by the definite article. P. Nomos. Now, but now, without, connected only to this being something that at the time Paul is writing it has happened and perfectly been completed, but the benefits remain to the present. So the precision lets you know that this is a past occurrence, but now as I preach it, it's in contrast to the previous and more past, the righteousness of works. Now there is burst on the scene this light. It already came at the time of Paul's writing and at the time of this translation. But being past, the present benefits, and but now, without the law. Two, one of the rarities of classical Coptic, where the A is substituted for the E as a preposition, the righteousness, definite article, the righteousness, genitive particle of, which tells you that the next word is the possessor of that which has just been said. Ephanut, this is a nomina sacra, which is a shorthand for the full name of God, Ephanut. What they're saying is, but now, past done, without, at the time it happened, when God bent down low, without, nomos, but made definite with the definite article, but now, without nomos, get behind me. And they have an interesting syntax here. But now, without the law, to the righteousness of God, you following that awkward literalism? But now, apart from without the law, I want to get on with the conversation. The previous conversation said, righteousness by works, the law, nobody's saved. But now, without the law, which didn't save anybody, let's get on with it. To the righteousness of ethnot. I want to analyze this word. This word, me, and the total word, meet me, and the third block, mehi, all make up. Interestingly enough, this word me means truth and means love. And they translate it with the agapao word in the New Testament. They translate it with another word for truth, aletheia, and they translate it with the kaiosuni. It means that in their thinking, this righteousness, which is truth incarnate, which is a contract a faithful God will keep, is a contract in love. And interestingly enough, we have the same thing in Ethiopic. I don't want to go through it all the way, but they say a righteousness of God while not enslaving to the mandates of Orit, their holy scripture, the Octatuk. But in every case, righteousness, Sedeka, in the Ethiopic, Kanuta, in the Syriac, Sedeka, in the Hebrew, and Adlu in the Arabic, righteousness is feminine. My brain, you know, you can't make too much of these things, but my brain always gets tuned into these things. It's like in Isaiah 53, who is he that, who he amends the hearing of us, and to whom is the arm of the Lord revealed? And the arm is feminine. Now, I've already said it, you scholars don't go turning handsprings now, listen to the rest of what I'm saying. But there's suggestions in gender, particularly in some of these languages where the verbs have gender. Law, nomos, law is masculine. Righteousness is feminine. You know, it's too bad all these feminists that want to change the Bible because it's got some personal pronouns about our Father haven't got enough brains or real discipline to study the Scriptures in their original languages. Righteousness is feminine. Let's hear it from the women. Righteousness is feminine. And it comes out most profoundly in this Coptic word, where truth and love are meshed, and righteousness, and this word, this third one, is justice and truth and love. All like the air that this word breathes, made up of three components, is truth, righteousness, love. Unlike law, which beats you to death, righteousness is motivated by love. The Creator who can do this bent down and created a new thing, a righteousness that He's going to give us based upon, and that's the next verse. This genitive then moves us of God. A righteousness certainly standing equal to the Torah or the Orit or the Sharia. This is of God also. And here again we have the past, was, and the pronoun she, because it's talking about the righteousness, which is feminine, love and truth. So this grammatical form of the Bukharic Coptic, you have your tense, as close as we can come to that. Past was actually perfect, which means it's completed. She was Luohi, O-U, long O, N-H, O-U-hi, Ebo. Again, the pronoun that was substituted here, or rather the preposition to, and bo, which means out. Now let me pull that apart. The whole verse is going to say now, but now, without the law, having spent 3 chapters and 20 verses on that law that does nothing, saves nobody. But now, without the law, to the righteousness of God, she was pushed out. She manifested herself out with a sense of the tension. I've been waiting to be seen. That's the beauty of these languages that prepare us for what is the next verse, which I already dabbled in. The faith, even the faith. Not in Jesus the Christ, even in the pattern of the faith of Jesus. The pattern, that which we are to imitate, that Hebrews 12 says, looking unto Jesus, the author, literally first goer and finisher of our, is in italics added by the translators, of faith. Now, Paul will add the crowning insult to the self-righteous egotist of the old way. Having discarded as a saving instrument the Torah, which is, as the canon, owes its existence. I'm going to make a word up to the Torahizer. Some were so fanatical about the Torah, they said God had to consult it before He created the earth. The Torah was elevated above God. When we get to the 27th verse, when Paul will say, you ain't got no exclusive grabs on Torah. Torah is nothing other than God-ordained pattern. And he asks the question, where is boasting? There is none for us. And he concludes, what is it then? The Torah of works, ergon. And what we have pulled apart here, we know he's only talking, when he uses this ambiguous word, of a religious, God identified set of rules to be kept en route to some perfection of complete keeping, and thus you are made superior and have a glorious entrance into heaven because your works got you there. That's the only noma he's using in this context. And now he throws it at them in their face and says, in the 27th verse, what is it then? A Torah of works? No, emphatically. And he grabs their word, no, it's the Torah of faith. So he then takes their exclusive claim and say, God's the one that Torahizes, as I made the word up, and he's got a new Torahizing product. It's a brand new Torah. Your Torah brings death. But there's a new Orit. There's a new Torah. There's a new Nomos. There's a new Sharia. And that new one brings life. All you have to do is do what Jesus did. Trust God to keep his promise and hang your body on it all the way to death. And Tozer says, a lot of people want resurrection without knowing death comes in front of resurrection. Your state of mind has to be, God said it, and instead of looking for a new list of checkbox that I can be done with behavior, and thus I'm all right, and my fellow Christians admire me because I'm doing a little better than they are at it, how about finding a faith challenge? You're sick? I'm the Lord that healeth thee. You're worried about tomorrow? The eternal God is your refuge. He's on the corner before you get there. I expect to lay foundations where the nitro pill messages will have more meaning to you. You're worn out in a valley of weeping? Blessed men go through. You're tithing? That's a faith act. Even the non-Jews were given the promise. Prove me now herewith. Faith looks past the scene and sees the God eternal who set the pattern in his Son, who left heaven's glory. For this cause I came with one little promise. If he walks this path, God will raise him up and give him a name which is above every name. Every day you face the opportunity. Something you see contradicts and threatens you. And God's word of promise says, be not afraid. Like David, what time I'm afraid, I will trust in the Lord. God's word of promise says, no matter what's hitting on you, Romans 8, God enters in. All things don't work together for good. What Romans 8 says, God enters in to all things to work his good to them which are the called according to his purposes. I could go on for another 2 hours. The difference between a set of rules and self-righteous performance. Am I against ethics? No, I think somebody that follows the Ten Commandments is a better neighbor than one that doesn't. We're not talking about ethics. We're talking about righteousness, and we're talking about the breath of eternity on you and whether or not you make it in. God bent down and created something new. A righteousness of love that says, I know you can't do it. And the purpose of that old Torah was a mirror to teach you you can't do it. And how sickening these hypocritical, white-suited performers trying to make you think they're keeping it. They aren't keeping it. We're all sinners. Being saved, we're all in the same boat. Only faith will take us home. And without faith now, it's impossible to please God. Ask yourself the last 6 days. how much your Christianity was performance of not doing normally what you've been told is wrong, or faith. Faith doesn't know the word, I can't. Faith doesn't say if or why. Faith says, me and God can. And faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidencing of things not seen. That's our part. That's the door of opportunity, something we can do, that the new righteousness is then implanted as a gift of God, and she will work herself out. Spirituality is the expressions of the Spirit. That's she, the righteousness of God, working herself out. You fade, she'll work the righteousness out. That's my message.